Let's say that you had studied a little Buddhism or attended some teachings or some retreats, and you were still on the fence a little bit about becoming a Buddhist, which of course is not at all necessary for awakening. Having a Sangha, not necessary for awakening, but to not do those things is a little bit like wanting to be a symphony musician and not joining the symphony. But to each his own. So what are some of the benefits of holding the many views of Buddhism? By view, I mean perspective, lenses that we can put on, try on, see whether or not our life makes sense in a way which is more productive to us. I like these especially because they are not presented as truths, but as experiments. And one can hold the experiment in body and speech and mind and see what transpires. So what is the benefit of considering lifetimes as multiple and continuous events? Reincarnation, you know, multiple lives. One of the benefits that I've noticed is that if you hold the view of multiple lifetimes long enough, the fear of death, the concern of death, gets less potent. It arises less frequently in a way which is bothersome. And when you think, oh, I've lived many lifetimes before this, then there's a kind of giving up that happens with trying to constantly find the reason why you have this habit and why you are the way you are. So we can still analyze it, of course, but the kind of core obsession with why can be dropped. As Rumi said, the question and the answer are buried in different lifetimes. And also, if one is discouraged in one's practice, we can think it's okay. I'll do my best in this lifetime to accomplish what I can. Open my heart more. And perhaps in the next lifetime or some subsequent lifetime, I will gain proficiency. Perhaps even remarkable proficiency. And what about the view of karma without worrying about whether or not karma is in fact true? When we hold that lens of karma, we begin to see that karma represents a great opportunity for change. It's a conditioned truth. Every habit that we have comes together through events, collision of causes and condition, and anything that comes together in that way can also be changed. And so anything about your life and your way of being which is not satisfactory to you, we need not worry. We need to just begin to change one thing at a time. As we do that, we have new results. As we have the new results, we find new impacts, new feedback. We learn, adjust, carry on. So what do you get by embracing impermanence? Well, one of my favorite things is if you're having a difficult time, you can remind yourself, this will not last. It cannot last. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is so is it also true in this view for all positive things, everything that you want to stay, the right relationship, the right job, and so forth, the right state of health or vitality. Those things also are subject to impermanence, of course. But there's a kind of relaxing that happens. Not with any particular event that may or may not be true, but with the broadest view and experience of your life. You feel it's something like the tides going in and the tides going out. And so for me, there has been a reduction in concern and worry and dwelling in negative events or difficult periods. And also not being so hyped up when something is really quite wonderful, enjoying it fully. I'm not suggesting that we don't find joy in things, of course. But also that joy is modulated, not flattened, but tempered by the reality, the fact of life, that it too will pass. What comes about by holding the view that altruism is a core value in life? When we hold this view of altruism as paramount among our efforts and our intentions, we begin to reshape relationships, people we love, our communities. And as we do this, of course, it creates a more wholesome container for our own life. So the entire container is more wholesome, and we have the satisfaction of seeing that our own interactions are part of the reason this container is more wholesome. And so there's some joy in that. So what comes about through embracing the view that obstacles are excellent fuel for one's spiritual awakening? This is really kind of a sneaker contemplation, I think, a sneaker experiment. In the beginning, I can remember feeling a lot of resistance. Oh, I see this event is for my awakening. Yeah, well, it still is kind of rotten. And yet, almost any spiritual tradition or even secular wisdom tradition, contemplative people will tell you that when we survive the disasters in our life, we learn things, we find out things about ourselves. We become stronger, more efficacious, more stable, more reliable, and we also understand that a difficult period is not the end of us necessarily. When we are practitioners of Buddhism, of course, we see that our most cherished aims are practiced and honed. And we have learning about the things, freedom, for example, that matter the most to us, compassion, loving kindness. So, of course, all of those things that we suffer about remain difficult, challenging in the moment, but it smooths out the longer view, I think, smooths it out. We have a way to meet those challenges with intention and a sense of, you know, down the road, we will look back and say, that was good. I learned some things. I made some progress as a human being. I got to know myself. And I'm one step closer then to liberation and to manifesting the values which are more core to me. Of course, if you wanted to be old school about it, you could also make part of that view of embracing obstacles as fuel for the path, that this is a chance for purification. I think it's good to think of purification as clarifying or resolving confusion about things. And so as we work through our obstacles, we begin to have opportunities for realizing different truth and truth at a different level. And then maybe the last one is, what about the view of embracing selflessness, no self, you know, and emptiness? Without that matrix of experience and concept of no self and emptiness, we exist as, you know, my kids used to say, we exist as little pieces of meat running around making mistakes. That's one way to think of it. But when we think of ourselves as empty, meaning ever changing, meaning interrelated with everything else, then there's a kind of alive dynamic that fuses itself to our concept of who we are. And we see that we are constantly changing and infinitely changing. And the far end of that understanding is the understanding that I am not this little piece of meat running around the earth, but my mind, my awareness, my essence does not exist in the way which I thought that it did. It cannot be killed. It was not born. It cannot be hurt. It cannot be diminished. It will not go away. There is a kind of liberation, not so much when you contact this conceptually, but if in one moment you should happen to experience yourself as timeless, infinite, ever-changing matrix of energy, you will not forget. No matter how small or short that experience is, you will not forget, and it will always remain something that, even if not a belief, will remain as a kind of vital and lively question in your life. Could this be my essence? Could this be who or what I am, so to speak? Could this be the nature of myself, could it be the nature of all things? And the kind of curiosity about that has always had for me a warm, welcoming, relief-filled, hopeful, and I mean that in a wholesome way, not like grasping hope, but just joyful perspective. So those are some of the views of Buddhism and a few of my thoughts, as you have asked in this interview, about why we would want to bother holding those views, those perspectives, if we don't know for sure whether or not they're true. Why would we engage in those things as experiments?